for coming today. I'm sorry we're in this smaller room, but the National Liberal Club are very kind to us, and they give us the use of their premises, and they had something else on in the bigger room today. And as I said earlier, owing to the interest in our speaker today, Mike, there's a seat here at the front. Can't have you standing at the back. Can't have you standing at the back.
Didn't used to be.
As usual, we will finish as near to 2 o'clock as we can so people can get away. If I could just give you one or two housekeeping notes. The next lunchtime event is on Tuesday the 24th of February when the debate which we're going to have is entitled Is the Middle East Peace Process Dead? Our panellists will be Malcolm Bruce, Chairman of the International Development Select Committee, Alistair Crook, who's the founder of Conflicts Forum and is based in Beirut, Lorna Fitzsimmons, who's the Chief Executive of the Britain-Israel Communications and Research Centre, and Andrew Wilson of Sky News, who I understand will be fresh back from the region at that time. And I think, hopefully, we will have a very exciting, perhaps not too heated, a debate on what has happened to the Middle East peace process. It won't be in this room, it will be on that occasion in the room next door. If any of you are interested, as usual, let Jacqueline know when you leave. Today, I'm delighted to say we managed to persuade Lord Robertson, George Robertson, to come and speak to us. We decided on the 60th anniversary, or almost the 60th anniversary, of NATO. It was time to look at NATO and where NATO's future role lay. It's not just because it's 60 years old, but because I think it is facing some very unusual challenges at the moment. We heard Ambassador Richard Holbrooke talking about Afghanistan being a total mess, and we are there with NATO in the middle of it, and I'm sure that George Robertson will address that. We're also looking at the whole question of expansion and whether, if we do expand NATO into countries such as Georgia, whether Article 5 will ever really apply, and if it doesn't, what the implications are for NATO as a whole. George Robertson needs no introduction, but I'm going to give him a short one. He is the Deputy Chairman of TNKBP and Senior International Advisor to Cable and Wireless. He was my colleague in Parliament as Member of Parliament for Hamilton and Hamilton South from 1978 to 1999. He was the United Kingdom Defence Secretary in 1997. In the October 1999, he was appointed the 10th Secretary General of NATO and was elevated to the House of Lords. And I think everybody who watched his progress in that particular job was filled with admiration for the way that he handled the conduct of NATO at what was a difficult time in his history. I could go on for a very long time, but George, if you'll forgive me for not telling them all about the rest of your most interesting life, I'm going to hand over to George now. I'm going to ask him to speak for us for about 25 minutes, and after that, as usual, we'll open it to questions. But I'm delighted to be able to say that we have the real expert on NATO with us here today. The question is, does NATO have a future? George Robertson.
Thank you, Alan. Michael and I used to have a sort of double act in public about me joking about him being the Marquess of Lothian and pretending to be a proletariat. Unfortunately, my elevation to the House of Lords somewhat negatived that particular jokey exchange there as well. But it's a delight to be here today. This debate about NATO is going to intensify, and we'll see a lot of and hear a lot of it in the next few weeks as we approach the anniversary, the 60th anniversary of NATO's creation. A bit much more in my mind at the moment is the anniversary that will take place 6 weeks today, which will be the 24th of March and the 10th anniversary of the launch of air attacks in Kosovo following the actions of Slobodan Milosevic, probably the first time that the British Armed Forces had taken action as part of a NATO force without the cover of a United Nations Security Council resolution. And I still remember vividly to that day. But NATO seems almost every 4 years to go through a crisis of identity, with speculation about whether it's relevant, whether it needs to exist, whether it should be there, or whether it's actually got a major crisis inside it. But roughly every 4 to 5 years, an event comes along which proves that NATO is still important and highly necessary. after the end of the Cold War, when NATO, in many ways, should have disappeared, its raison d'etre having disappeared with the collapse of the Soviet Union, it was a role picked up, an essential and important role picked up at that time to help the newly emerging democracies of Central and Eastern Europe to manage the transition from communism to the mixed economies. And in 1995, of course, when the West decided, Europe decided that they could no longer tolerate what was going on in Bosnia and Herzegovina, they had to turn to NATO to take military action there to stop the crisis and stabilise that country. And then in 1999, in Kosovo, NATO again was the only instrument of policy to stop the ethnic cleansing. In the year 2001, when civil war almost broke out in Macedonia with all the telltale signs of moving to a bloodbath of Balkan proportions, it was again NATO, and this time with the European Union, that stepped in there. And since then, NATO has been called into Pakistan for the earthquake, Darfur to deal with to help the African Union deal with the crisis, the humanitarian crisis there, into Somalia, where the original action against the pirates was taken, and in a host of other smaller areas where only NATO, in its political form, and the Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, with its military logistics organisation, were called in there. And of course, now in the centre of our debate is, as you said, Michael, Afghanistan. A commitment taken on around the table by 19 countries with the support of the other aspirant members at that time. A collective, unanimous decision that the coalitions of the willing that had applied up until then would have to be replaced by a NATO-led force. I think Emil Jones-Parry, who's in the audience, may well remember at that particular time when the obligation was taken on. And I warned them then, as many other people did, that it was not something that could be taken lightly, nor was it without major responsibilities. Sadly, I think some people had forgotten that. But if you look at the world today, the world in which NATO is coming to its 60th anniversary, on the plus side, there is no existential threat to our existence. There is no Soviet Union, there is no Nazi Germany, there is no Imperial Japan, there is no threat to our existence or to our way of life, and the threats that Al-Qaeda makes are not to be taken seriously. There is no Cold War. The Russians have found that they are part of an interconnected financial world and in a devastating way recently. And there is therefore no daily possibility or likelihood of nuclear annihilation. So that is on the asset side of today's world. But of course, as time has moved on, there are new vulnerabilities, new threats, new challenges to us. And some of them are pretty potent and pretty dangerous as well. I co-chair at the moment with Paddy Ashdown, a Commission on National Security in the 21st Century. The IPPR hosted, but it has an assembly of experts, bipartisan experts in there. That is our interim report, and if you haven't seen it or read it, it's available on the internet, and we'll go into much greater detail about some of what I'm going to say now than I can possibly do justice in these few minutes that I've got here as well. And the biggest of the vulnerabilities that we face in the world today is the interconnectedness of us all. The nature of globalization that produces huge benefits also produces a multiplication of vulnerability. And as if we didn't know it before, the financial crisis that started just last year shows how one small step can lead to a multiplication of dramatic events. A financial crisis where we still don't know how deep it is, how long it's going to be, or how far it's going to go. Maybe Ed Balls does, but the rest of us, I think, are shrouded in mystery. But it shows us that the butterfly wings of the chaos theory have really now become a reality. And therefore, when you look at each of the other challenges that we face today, the number of failed states in the world, including some with nuclear potential. Risks to health. The SARS epidemic in 2003 killed 10% of all of those who contracted it, and it spread to 4 continents in 24 hours. If you had a pandemic, it is estimated by experts that if you had a pandemic, a flu pandemic of the nature we had in 1918 and 1919, today it would kill something like 145 million people and cost something like $4 trillion in lost wealth. Nuclear proliferation, a problem now that has gone way beyond the permanent five in the UN Security Council, into dirty bombs and radioactive devices that can be accessible by non-state actors as well as states itself. And of course we face terrorism and organised crime with new global reach. And that's not to mention energy insecurity, climate change, and this new dramatic threat that we've seen on the west of Africa, of piracy on the high seas as well. So today we need a new definition of security, a definition that goes much wider than simply military defence. And we need institutions, not necessarily new institutions, but institutions that can adapt and do adapt and will adapt to this new breed of workable multilateralism that will be the only answer to the kind of threats and challenges that we will face in the future. So there are a number of choices, not many of which are actually debated among the public today as to how we deal with making people safe in this new era of these new new threats and with the new vulnerabilities. Do we do it on our own and protect our own borders? There is still a substantial school of thought that thinks that, and it's a substantial school of thought that still drives military budgets related to yesterday's enemies and not tomorrow's threats. We could, of course, simply do what Prime Minister of one Central American country said to me when I said, why did they have no defence forces? They said, our defence policy is the telephone line to Washington. And although that might sound like a banana republic, sadly, there are many parts of the world where people believe that that is the only policy and the most desirable one for them as well. Or we could, apropos of Donald Rumsfeld's famous quote, consider coalitions of the willing. Ad hoc coalitions dreamt up, assembled whenever any crisis, a particular crisis, was to come along. Opportunistic coalitions. Or we could recognise the imperative of the new multilateralism required and go for permanent, tried, tested and experienced multilateral and treaty-based coalitions, of which NATO is the paramount organisation. Of course, they have, like the NATO has, like the United Nations and indeed the European, got its flaws and its problems and an obsession sometimes with process over execution. But NATO has managed the transition from the old Cold War organisation that faced the Soviet Union in its original form into a dramatically different organisation today that is, on one hand, a political forum embracing Canada and the United States with all of the European countries, and now right across Europe with only Belarus from the old Warsaw Pact, now not a full member of NATO and the European Union. So NATO is not just a military organisation and could not possibly survive if it was simply a military organisation. The military component is central and it is absolutely pivotal and must be there at the end of any diplomatic process. But it isn't actually even the main business of NATO today, which is Finland, is to do with the politics of security globalisation. I found a quote which I think summed it up remarkably well, and it comes from the head of an institute in Finland, which is, of course, not, at the moment, a member of NATO, Mr. Risto Pentala, who is the director of the Finnish Business and Policy Forum. He picked up a soundbite of mine that was NATO is not the world's policeman, and said it sends a clear signal, yet, he said, it doesn't stand up to closer scrutiny. NATO provides law and order to the people of Bosnia and Herzegovina. It patrols sea lanes in the Mediterranean. It provides assistance to victims of hurricanes and earthquakes. It escorts children to school in Afghanistan. It educates officers in post-communist states in the virtues of democracy. It provides logistic support for the African Union. It incarcerates war criminals. It fights terrorism. He said, these are not war-fighting operations. They can't even be classified as hardcore crisis management. And he concluded that speech by saying, NATO is the only show in town. A Finn. They were among my strongest supporters, it had to be said, in NATO, although they still can't make up their mind as to whether they want to actually be part of the organisation. But I think that encapsulates, and that was written 2 years ago, the range of things that NATO does today, but which are largely unknown to the public as a whole. So NATO, and with the growing role of the European Union in crisis management and crisis resolution, has become a relevant and important part of the whole structure that we need for the future in the European part of this globalised and vulnerable community. I noticed that President Sarkozy, who we all hope is going to bring France back into the military structures of NATO in the next few weeks, made a valuable and a very important, not a terribly original, but one point that needs we need reminded of. He said that NATO was an alliance of European countries and not just an alliance between the United States and Europe. And occasionally, and Emil Jones-Parry will remember this only too well, the same ministers can sit in a meeting in Brussels and be the absolute proponents of NATO as the primary organisation, and then go down the road to the Justus Lipsius building to a meeting of EU defence ministers and become absolutely part of that identity as well. It used to be said that NATO and the EU shared the same city but different planets. And that undoubtedly was true for a period. I think that was the time when Josef Luns was Secretary General of NATO and was once famously asked at a press conference, Mr. Secretary General, how many people work at NATO? And he said, well, about half. But actually both of these things are not true anymore, and the organisations work closely together, and the very small core staff of NATO is massively, massively overworked and living within a budget that the British Treasury and the German Finance Ministry keep ridiculously small for the kind of responsibilities that it takes on. The arrangements called Berlin Plus will be unknown even to, I think, this expert audience. So many grannies in this room that I am seeking to teach to suck eggs. But Berlin Plus were these complicated procedural arrangements put in place to allow the European Union to use NATO assets in a crisis where NATO was not involved. That needs to come to life, and maybe French accession to the integrated military structure will bring that about, because the organisations need to work in tandem. They both have key strengths that are not shared by each other. And in future, if we're going to be able to deal with crises, there needs to be a toolbox, there needs to be a range of measures, there has to be a package of measures that is not simply resolving the conflict, preventing the conflict, but also sorting the aftermath of conflicts. We are very good, both in NATO and the EU, in doing lessons learned exercises. They're very ambitious, they're usually done very thoroughly. What we are pathetic at doing is implementing any of the lessons learned. And I came to NATO in 1999 and they showed me the volumes of lessons learned from Bosnia and Herzegovina and the embryonic piles of documents that were the lessons learned from Kosovo. And yet, at every crisis you can imagine, even today, people feel they've got to reinvent the wheel and don't feel that it's necessary to go back and look at what the lessons were. One of my aides in NATO, Mark Leahy, who used to, I guess, Frank Gardner's position in the BBC, was once BBC's defence editor, has written a very small but hard-hitting report about the Macedonia crisis of 2001, published by the Royal United Services Institute, and I thoroughly recommend it to you as a sort of example of a crisis that was solved. There are plenty of books about the crisis that are ongoing, and there's plenty of them getting attention today, but this was one that we actually took on and stopped and solved. So what are the big challenges now facing NATO as an organisation? Just want to deal with three. First of all is enlargement. Are we actually going to hang up a sign that says no entry, full up? Could we possibly turn our back on countries that have democratised, that have changed and have adapted and say, sorry, you can't get in? I don't think that that is feasible or realistic. And a lot of promises have been made, highly publicised ones at Bucharest for Ukraine and for Georgia, but also to other countries geographically and in many other ways in between. And if you look at that list and you reflect on what NATO would be like in terms just of size, you begin to realise that the adaption of NATO is going to be a formidable challenge in the future. Croatia and Albania are likely to be invited into full membership in a few weeks' time at the summit meeting on the 3rd of April. Macedonia should be getting an invitation, but scandalously and indefensibly is being kept out by an obscure and ridiculous argument over the name of the country, blocked by one other country, its neighbour Greece. But Macedonia, when that is resolved, as it must be resolved, will become a member of NATO. And then after that, Kosovo, Montenegro, I believe Serbia, within a decade, will want to be a full member of NATO, and Moldova. That takes you up to 33 countries in the alliance. And then if you go to Ukraine and to Georgia, and possibly Sweden and Finland as well, because the debate rages there over whether they should be full members of the alliance and not just very significant troop contributors to NATO operations, then you're up to 37 countries in an alliance that was basically designed for 9 or 10 countries at the beginning of the day. Now that is, we have to start thinking, conceptualising about an organisation that is like that. If they found it impossible to say no at Bucharest to Ukraine and to Georgia, who are nowhere near the standards and conditions that we've laid down in the past, then those other countries must fit in to that envelope of NATO membership as well. And if that is the case, and that is the size, and that is the range of countries in there, then why is Russia not seen as part and parcel of that family? Would not that suggestion, tied to the conditions that must be there for any country to join NATO, why is it not seen as part of that more global organisation that might perhaps give a lead to other parts of the world in terms of common security arrangements as well? So enlargement is something that is going to happen, can't be stopped, but poses a number of thought processes that are extremely important. Not just whether the Article 5 guarantee can be given to countries like Georgia, but the Article 5 guarantee itself and all that goes along with it. NATO survived for 55 years without Article 5 being invoked. And I must say that, you know, as the person who read out the statement that day on the 12th of September 2001, I was halfway down reading the statement before I began to recognise just how important and how significant it was, what we'd done that day. Capabilities is at the very heart of an organisation that is involved with crisis management. We've got a lot of provisions in place for crisis prevention, doing it with the European Union as well. But when the crisis comes, are we capable? Are the European countries, the NATO countries, capable of being able to deal with the next potential crisis of whatever nature that is? Why have we so few usable troops? 2% of the troops that are actually on the Ministries of Defence score sheet. 2% of the 2.5 million people in Europe, in the European countries at the present moment, are actually usable in any real sense of the world. That is a scandal for any defence organisation. And of course it's a huge liability as well, and a waste of money. We don't have enough of the aeroplanes, we don't have enough of the mobile equipment that would be required, and we are chronically short, as we see in Afghanistan, of things like helicopters and of what is known in the military as combat support and combat service support, the signalers, the engineers, the doctors, the logisticians, without whom forces simply cannot move. You cannot get anybody to a crisis, deal with any crisis, unless you've got these people. And yet they are in the shortage of supply throughout the whole of the alliance as well. So the capabilities have got to be mobile and they've got to be usable. And I would suggest that they have also got to include the other components for post-conflict reconstruction. Because if there was ever any lesson that we learned from Bosnia and Kosovo, we're learning in Afghanistan and from all of the others, that actually the military piece is sometimes the easiest bit to deal with. It is the civilian reconstruction afterwards that poses the biggest dilemma and problems for all of us. Now, I just ask people to reflect when I talk about this, and that is that at the moment, in the last few weeks, we've all been preoccupied by the conflict between Israel and its Palestinian neighbours. We all of us hope that the incoming Obama administration, the appointment of George Mitchell, new emissaries, a new drive, perhaps after today's election in Israel, to actually stop this conflict before the cancer keeps spreading in the way that it has. We all want that. I don't think there's anybody in this room or anybody outside of this room who doesn't want that to happen. Yet we all know that if an agreement was reached, there would be a need for a stabilisation force. That could not simply be American. That would be unacceptable to one party. And could not possibly be European, because that might be unacceptable for the other. There is only one organisation in the world, and it's not the United Nations, that can actually supply multinational forces that are capable of integrating and working in a conflict, a post-conflict situation, and that is NATO with the Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe, shape. Could we do it? Despite all the protestations of what we want to do, could we do it? And the answer, the simple answer, is no, we can't. There is absolutely no way, with only 2% of forces in Europe actually deployable, that the European countries, even with America, would be able to deliver that sort of force. So in a way, that is the soft underbelly of the sentiment that is around. We want to will the end. We seem incapable of thinking through the means that would be required for that as well. And my final challenge that lies before us for NATO in the future is one of political will. You know, we are at war at the moment. This country is at war. We have troops in action dying almost weekly out there in Afghanistan. It is our front line. They're not there to defend President Karzai. They're not there to democratize Helmand Province. They are there specifically to defend us. Because a post-Karzai or a post-democratic Afghanistan in the hands of the Taliban is a direct threat to us and to our interests and to our people's safety. I used to say it, my successor has said it, the Defence Secretary says it, if we don't go to Afghanistan, Afghanistan will come to us. As it did on the 11th of September. Failed states, harbouring Al-Qaeda and the rest of them. So that message needs to get over. You know, I recently read the great John Luchak's book about 8 days in August 1940, when on paper, after Dunkirk, this country was defeated. We were defeated. We had our resources, our military capabilities on the other side of the channel, and Hitler moving down, already occupying occupying France. What kept us going, what led to the ultimate victory, was a national resolve that we were not going to be defeated. And we are at that point in history now, where governments and political leaders have got to make up their mind that we either win out there or we lose out there. And if we lose out there, then we're going to be fighting people over here as well. And I think that requires, right across the NATO countries, including this one, a much greater determination to face people with the consequences of failure in Afghanistan. And I think this casualty averseness, this view that we cannot possibly accept any of these casualties in distant lands because it's nothing really to do with us and our own security or our own safety, is simply not sustainable. And it's not true. It's not true. The enemy may not be at the door, but in a globalised world, he can be quite far away and still penetrate the door at the same time. And I think we need to do much more. It's a sort of chief debating point in a way, but you'll appreciate this as a Tory MP. I looked, I went to the Ministry of Defence website today, and which this was I used to own, and I typed in NATO, and up came two A4 sheets of paper with a brief history of what NATO has done and is doing at the moment. But it says, external links, Foreign and Commonwealth Office, Terrorism and Security, NATO. So I duly got the computer, clicked on that, and up came this page, which says, this page has been archived. after a further 10 or 15 minutes, I managed to get to the Foreign Office's web page on NATO, which directed me to a very fine web page from the British delegation to NATO. No doubt previous ambassadors set it up unknown to the public. But that's a little indication of what we need to do. First of all, to emphasise the importance of NATO as a unifying influence between the United States, Canada, and all of these European countries. The importance of the missions that NATO is involved in, the way in which NATO has adapted, and how important that transatlantic relationship has been for these last 60 years. So NATO, I believe, has a future. Of course it has a future. If it doesn't have a future, we will not have a future either. But we've got to want it to have a future. And we've got to be able to give it the right resources and the political support to make sure that it can do the job that we all know it needs to do in the future. Thank you very much.